Welcome to the Iron Butterfly Podcast. My name is Megan Jaffer.
And I'm Katie Hopkins, and we will be your hosts.
We created Iron Butterfly Podcast in honor of Eloise Page, the original Iron Butterfly. 80 years ago, Eloise joined the Office of Strategic Services, trailblazing a path for what ultimately became the United States intelligence community. She rose the ranks from secretary to case officer, defying the norms of her time, and eventually became the first female chief of station at CIA. Eloise was known among her colleagues to be a fierce fighter with a core of steel, and she earned the codename Iron Butterfly. Our podcast continues her legacy, inviting the unsung heroines of the United States intelligence community to share their stories with aspiring leaders like you. Women in the intelligence community are special because they have dedicated their lives to studying the whole world. And through conversations with hundreds of women in intelligence over the past few years, we have come to understand that the world is at an inflection point. Women hold a more central role in society than ever before. And at Iron Butterfly Media, we are committed to amplifying authentic voices that inspire women to create wherever they are. So pull up a chair. Our changing world needs new ideas made real, which begins with you. Welcome to Iron Butterfly Podcast.
Hi, my name is Mary Rose McCaffrey. I am thrilled to be with you this evening. I was the first female director of security for CIA and am currently an advisory board member for Sim Software, who is the sponsor of the Iron Butterfly Podcast this evening. I am with a very dear friend and former colleague, Ms. Linda Weisgold, and I am thrilled on behalf of Sim Software and Iron Butterfly to introduce Emily Hewitt. Emily is a member of the amazing women of the intelligence community and a senior at Marymount University. She's currently studying forensic and legal psychology with an emphasis on intelligence studies. Emily, it is thrilled to be with you this evening, and I turn it over to you to introduce our esteemed guest.
Well, thank you. Hi, guys. My name is Emily Ann Hewitt, and I am so excited to be joining everyone for Iron Butterfly's first student feature. Beginning with an overview of myself, I am currently a graduate student at Marymount University, enrolled in their forensic and legal psychology program with a core concentration in intelligence studies. This was actually a career change for me, as most of my background is in clinical therapy, and I am a counselor right now. I actually work at a residential facility in Centerville, Virginia, where I run their evening group program called Mindfulness. With this said, I am more than happy I switched my trajectory to intelligence, as there are far more opportunities for growth. My professor and advisor, Linda Millis, is the main factor as to why I switched. She has really taught me how intelligence interacts with policy, decision-making, and understanding human behavior. So rather than studying the motivations of one client, I rather my research be applied to movements, groups, or nations. Since beginning my program, I cultivated a passion for national security and made it my goal to indulge myself in the intel community. First, I'm a mentee in the 2024 Girl Security Winter Cohort, in which I was paired with my wonderful mentor, Marie Loop. I'm also the vice president of the Marymount Intelligence Club. In this role, I help publish monthly newsletters, attend club meetings, and provide members and myself networking opportunities. Lastly, I am proud to be a member of the Amazing Women in Intelligence. I'm so thankful to be here and supporting this podcast. I love its mission to celebrate women in national security and the guidance it provides to its audience. But enough about me. I would like to introduce our episode guest, Linda Weisgold, the founder of Intformed LLC. She is also a soon-to-be professor at Texas A&M in Washington, D.C., and some of her favorite roles in her career include being an analyst on the Middle East, an analytical manager working on counterterrorism, a presidential briefer, and the head of CIA's director of analysis, but feels like her most important role is being a mother. She describes herself as tenacious, realistic, candid, and doesn't stand on ceremony. Since retiring, her hobbies include reading, cooking, and her volunteer work on literacy. Linda and her husband will celebrate their 35th wedding anniversary this year. And fun fact, they started working at the CIA on the same day. Linda, welcome to Iron Butterfly.
Linda, welcome to Iron Butterfly.
It is my pleasure to be here.
Do you know that? Oh, you were going to say the same
thing. I think we were going to say the same thing.
I think you're one of our most requested Iron Butterfly podcast guests of all time.
I mean, I can't even count them on both hands how many people recommended you. I mean, we get direct messages and emails from people we know, people we don't know.
Oh, that's really cool.
And you were the single most requested guest.
I will try to live up to that.
Well, welcome to Iron Butterfly. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, like I said, it is truly my pleasure. I think this is a great initiative that you guys are doing to highlight what is really, you know, stories that haven't been told. So I'm really pleased to do it.
Well, thanks.
Wonderful.
Well, we're going to just jump right in. You, I know, have listened to the podcast. I know that you're a supporter. So you know that we kind of start from the beginning. We want to know who you are, where you came from, what kind of made you you. So let's start from the beginning and tell us where you grew up and how you grew up and kind of what brought you to the intelligence community.
Sure. So I think I'm a rarity. I was actually born in D.C., and I grew up in Maryland, but my parents had nothing to do with the government.
Oh, wow.
And so I was, my parents were small business owners. My mom was a hairdresser and owned multiple salons. But I was, as I said, exposed to the D.C. area my whole life. I went to school at Georgetown. So I didn't travel far. And that was because I knew I wanted to do something international. Even in high school, I took two languages. I traveled overseas, did like a study abroad program for about a month in France when I was in high school. So I had been bitten by the bug early about wanting to do something international, but I didn't exactly know what I wanted to do. So as I said, I went to Georgetown School of Foreign Service. And then when I graduated, I still didn't know what I wanted to do. I thought about law school, but I am an experiential learner, and I didn't really know what a lawyer did. And before I invested all that money in law school, I decided I really wanted to find out. So I went to work as a paralegal for a while for one of the largest law firms in the U.S. Here in D.C., their D.C. office. And about a year, I realized that that was not the world I wanted to be part of. And there were a lot of really good things about it that eventually I applied to my work in an intelligence community, in particular research and sourcing and those kinds of things, argumentation. But I really hated the concept of billable hours. Mm. I hated the concept of doing something that, and this is not to belittle any lawyers, but I wanted to be able to go home and said that I had done something that was really meaningful. As opposed to having, hey, I got that Fortune 500 company had to pay less money to someone. So I was searching for what I wanted to do, and my arrival at CIA was actually total serendipity. But it's a great story for this podcast because it has its origins in the idea of women in leadership. So I was at the time living with some roommates in Arlington, and one of my roommates worked for a congresswoman on Capitol Hill, Pat Schroeder, who was very into women's issues. And my roommate had signed up for a seminar on women in leadership, and at the last minute, she couldn't go. So I often joke that part of my ending up at CIA was my lack of a social life, because at the last minute, she said, hey, do you want my tickets? I said, sure, I'm not doing anything. So I went. And the course was being taught, now again, this was the mid-1980s. The course was being taught by a woman who also taught courses at CIA on women in leadership.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that is cool.
So during the course, the seminar, it was a two-day seminar, there was a hijacking the night in between. So the second day, everyone comes in. Of course, that's what everyone's talking about. And I remember we started talking about the fact that all of these people had given up their tickets to go to Athens. And I said, I can't believe they did that. She looked at me and she said, really, you would go? And showing, I think, my initial analytic chops, I had a reason why. I said, absolutely. It's probably the safest place in the world. It's not going to happen two times in a row. The next day, I would absolutely get on the plane and go to Athens. And she said, I have some people you should talk to.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's kind of how I ended up at CIA, was this woman pointed me towards someone that I called. I thought I was calling for an informational interview. You'll have to remember this predates things like the internet. So I called up and this woman, you know, the person I spoke to, I said, yes, well, her name had been Jinx Malia was the author, the contractor who was teaching. She also wrote a book called Why Jenny Can't Lead. And so I said, yes, Jinx recommended. And he said, you know, we're having this test this coming weekend that we only give, you know, like twice a year. And I was, again, no social life. I was like, yeah, I can go.
Oh my God.
I had not filled out a shred of paperwork, which would never happen today. But I went and I took the test and apparently did really well because afterwards he was calling me like every day, I need you to fill out the application. I need you to fill out the application.
My goodness.
But that's how I ended up at CIA.
I've never heard a story like that before.
No, and like I said, it was serendipity, but I love to tell that story because I think people don't realize that, as I said, even in the 80s, we were already at CIA looking at things like women in leadership and talking about those issues. So
growing up here, so that's rare. I just want to point that out. There's not very many people from here. Everyone
moves
here.
Well, and also not just from Virginia or Maryland, but from
born in
D.C.
Yeah. Makes it hard to fill out forms.
So did you, I mean, were you aware of national security or was that like a foreign concept too? I mean, I'm sure you knew some of the three-letter agencies, but.
So it's really an interesting question. As I said, my parents weren't involved in government, but I grew up with the Washington Post as my local newspaper. And, you know, the Washington Post during the heyday of Watergate and all of those things when it was, it was quite a thing. And I remember one of the first times that I was old enough, we had left town, gone somewhere domestic, and the newspaper showed up somewhere. And I'm like, where's the rest of it? Right? Because I was, and you know, why is the fishing and hunting report on the front page? Where's the national news stories?
Yeah.
So I think I absorbed it that way. And my parents, while I'm actually the first in my family to get my undergraduate degree, my parents were both are both incredibly smart people. And so there was always an effort to feed my curiosity on things. Again, pre-internet days, my mother went out and bought a set of an Encyclopedia Britannica because apparently from the time I started talking, I kept asking why. So, you know, she would send me over and we would be able to look it up and things. So
that's really cool. One other thing that you said, which I find is interesting because I think it's kind of a common thread through the women that we have on the podcast, is you said you were just really drawn to like international or world scale problems. Like, I actually think it's something that we sometimes in this area or in this community take for granted because a lot of people just don't think like that. Why do you think you were drawn to those types of problems? Like, was it just that you traveled to France and thought it was cool and wanted to travel again? Or was there sort of a deeper reason?
I've never actually really thought about why, but as so many things in my life, I'm going to credit my mother. And I say that in part because my mother put me for some reason in a bilingual nursery school. And so I actually spoke French starting in nursery school.
Oh, wow.
And then I stopped and didn't do it again until much later. But I think from that early age, I realized there was more than just English and there was more than just what was going on, you know, locally. So I think that was part of it. And then also my family, my mother's first generation American. So I already knew, again, that idea of folks from overseas and other cultures and how that that was different, but important.
That's awesome. Do you think that that view changed once you got into government and kind of started studying world issues?
I'm sorry, the view of what changing?
Just your view on global scale problems. And I mean, it seems to you always kind of had this inkling that there was something else out there.
I think what probably changed when I became much more, I realized much more, is the interconnectedness of the world. You know, problems that we analyzed at CIA and that you deal with in national security, they don't stop at borders. So, you know, terrorism and terrorists don't get to a border and go, oh, you've got to stop, not going to cross that one. And so I think that interconnectedness was something that got reinforced over time for me. I know you like to call it the butterfly effect, but, you know, something can happen in a country in Africa and the next thing you know, there's, you know, new immigration policy somewhere. And yeah,
that's really cool. That's really cool. So let's go back to Linda, who's just passed this test and filled out her application, presumably successfully. So what was it like kind of entering the agency? Like, tell us about kind of where you first started.
Sure.
How you got your start.
So I came into CIA through a program that doesn't exist anymore, but it was called a career trainee program. And so it meant that I spent my first year at the agency with a group of folks from all of the other directorates, and then doing internships, if you will, or interim assignments in other directorates. And that was quite foundational for me, because from the very beginning of my career at CIA, I was kind of a one agency girl. I understood how it all fit together. My husband, who was not my husband at the time, but he entered on duty, or EOD'd as we call it, on the exact same day. He swears he saw me. He was sitting behind me in the in the big auditorium. He came in. He didn't have that. He came in as a direct hire and went immediately to work for the office that had hired him, working on counter-narcotics. But so, like I said, so I had that broad view early on. I had been sponsored for that by the Office of Near East and South Asia. So when I finished that assignment, I came and I started working on the Middle East. One of the lessons I often would tell new analysts later on in life was that flexibility is really important at the agency. It's part of the way that the agency maintains its agility. So at Georgetown University, I had studied international economics. I thought I was going to be an economist, and I thought I was going to be working on North Africa, because I had taken courses when I had done my junior year in college overseas in France. I had taken courses on North Africa, which is a bit of a rarity and things. But when I popped out at the end of my 1 year of training, these words again will never be uttered. We don't need an economist right now.
Oh my God.
And would you be willing to be a political analyst working on Lebanon? And so I remember, like, okay. And so I first started working on Lebanon. And it was a great experience. At that time, Lebanon, their civil war was booming. We had U.S. hostages. There was a lot of interest in it. But another lesson that I learned from that and tried to pass on is that I was, as a new officer, given the accounts that at the time were of lesser interest, if you will. So I was, while the Shia in Lebanon and Hezbollah and others, that was the areas of high policymaker interest. I was given as the accounts to work on the Sunnis, the Druze in Lebanon, and the Maronite Christians, which was really good because it gave me a chance to learn my craft, to learn how to be an intelligence officer. But one of the things that hooked me very early at the agency was it's not about your tenure. It's about your capabilities. So about, I don't know, 6-9 months into my time working the account, the Sunni prime minister was assassinated. And I wasn't asked to hand my work over to someone more senior. It was like, that's your account. You're up. And yes, I was given more, you know, kind of mentoring and help, but at least it wasn't taken away from me. Another couple months later, the Maronite Christian president was assassinated. And again, I was the one who was up. I was the one who was writing the pieces for the president. I was the one who was doing the briefings. And that hooked me. It was about capability and not about tenure. So
That's
so important.
So important, I think. And no one has ever said that on this podcast yet. So I think that's really important to hear.
Well, and I think the perception is that government organizations are so overly structured that that couldn't possibly be true, right?
So I think it's true. And, you know, you hear a lot about hierarchy and, you know, in the military, there are reasons for that. And there are reasons for a chain of command, don't get me wrong. But within the Directorate of Analysis at CIA, it has much more of a tradition akin to academia and the idea that good ideas can come from anywhere. And when I was the director of the director of analysis, I spent a lot of trying to remind people of that even the newest officer coming in brings new perspectives. They might be more current on tools. They might have more current information from their research in school. That it's not about how long you've been at the agency. It's about, like I said, the ideas and the exchange of ideas. So. Mm-hmm.
Totally. That's awesome.
I think people would be surprised to hear that too, because mm-hmm. I think they think, you know, these big organizations that have people who've been there for 50 years and that they're not going to think about the young kid coming in knowing the new, you know, they're this is how we do it and this is how we're always doing it, right? Mm-hmm. And so to hear you say, even
if you have an analyst, a senior analyst who is that rooted in, you know, this is how it's always been, that senior analyst needs to go, because it is so important. I think the most important question that an analyst can ask themselves is, how might I be wrong? Mm. Right. And just because I thought something, we've always said this is the way, we have to think about what has changed. Why might that be different today? How could we be wrong about it? And really challenge the thinking all the time. Mm-hmm. So like I said, I think one of the things that has worried me over time is that we need to be able to have that challenge of each other's ideas, civilly, of course, but analysis, I've always said analysis, it's a bit of a contact sport, right? Mm. Hopefully not full contact, but there is contact. And thinking may be solitary, but analysis isn't. You need to have that exchange of ideas, and you're working with your team, and you're coordinating your pieces. And so you have to be able to challenge each other. And occasionally I am finding that people are hesitant to do that. They don't want to hurt anyone's feelings. They're worried about how they're going to, you know, the long-term effect of that. And if we reach, as an organization, and even more so as a society, a point where we can't have that civil debate, then we will have lost, I think, an ability to progress and to advance ideas. So,
why do you think that is? Like, where do you think that comes from, that hesitance to challenge? Because it seems like the way that you put it, it's almost like it's out of care, right?
I think there is some of that is out of care. I think some of it is also out of a bit of fear, mm. right? You don't want to be seen as someone who is not receptive. So it's about how you respond. It's how you present the ideas, right? And the challenge to someone. So you are respectful about it, but, you know, asking questions like, but what about, you know, this piece of information? Why have you ignored it? Or did you see it? Or rather than years ago, when I was working on Lebanon, back then when you would coordinate a paper, now nothing at CIA is the work of one analyst. Mm-hmm. It is a corporate product. And that means that everyone who is working on that topic gets a say in that. And someone sent over a paper to my team from, actually it was working on counter-narcotics. And the person sent it over. So at that time I was now dating my now husband. And most folks didn't realize that. And so we had this particularly curmudgeonly analyst who worked for us in the team I was in. And he got that paper and he started to make comments on it. And he wrote these gratuitous, kind of nasty comments about the paper. And as it went around to the rest of the folks in the team, we said, come on, you're being too hard. And so he erased a bunch of he'd done it in pencil, he erased it. What he didn't realize, but I did because my husband was working at that team, is that they at that time had light tables for looking at imagery. Mm-hmm. So when the paper came over, they could see things had been erased. Oh. And they put it on the table and read all of the gratuitous comments.
Oh my gosh.
Which soured relations between our teams for quite some time. So like I said, I do think people are concerned about, you know, am I going to be seen as a troublemaker? Mm-hmm. How is someone going to take that? My challenging of their ideas. But again, like I said, you have to have a bit of a thick skin as an analyst to be able to stand up to both your colleagues, but also none of our customers, no policymaker should just accept at face value what the intelligence community provides. And I think that is one of the best things that came out of the lessons that we learned after Iraq WMD was it became much more of a dialogue with our customers. And the idea that a policymaker will say to you, but, you know, why do you think that?
Mm-hmm.
We should welcome that, not feel like we're being challenged, because ultimately the analytic tradecraft comes down to being able to explain why you think what you think.
Mm-hmm.
That is what mm-hmm. is at the heart of being an analyst. So when someone asks you that and someone challenges and says, I don't believe you, you should have all of your facts and your, you know, reasoning and your argumentation and be able to lay it out. Now, they may still not believe you. We're not the only source of information for a customer. I had the privilege of being a presidential briefer for President George W. Bush. And there were many times when, you know, we would put something in front of him and I'd be briefing it and he wasn't agreeing. And so, you know, I would get the chance, I would try to explain why the analyst, the reasoning behind it. But as I said, we weren't his only source of information. He was talking to world leaders himself. He was talking to members of Congress. He would bring in authors from books, and it was very quiet about it, but he would bring authors in and talk to them. And so, again, we're not their only source. Hopefully we're the most convincing source.
Mm-hmm.
But
how do you, I guess, mentor or teach the young analysts coming in to, you know, because you could look at that and say that that's kind of a, not a personality trait, but it's a trait where, like, you just might be more sensitive to criticism mm-hmm. or to, you know, a lot of analysts are very introverted, right? And so it's the combativeness, not in an aggressive way, but the combativeness of, you know, someone telling you, like, I don't agree with that, could be difficult. Do they, you obviously are a very good mentor and teacher, and so I can see you, you know, when you were there, and even now as a teacher, training your analysts to say, like, look, this is the way it goes, and you have to be willing to, you know, there's a push and pull to this job, right? But is there, you know, is that something that is taught to them early on, or is it something you just have to learn?
I think it's a combination. As I said, part of being an analyst, as I said earlier, is having that tough skin. There is analytic courage that is required mm-hmm. as part of the job. You know, when you have you know, a four-star general or president of the United States or someone looking at you and saying, I'm not buying it, I don't agree. All you can do is to lay out that argument. But again, and also realize that it's their right not to agree.
Right. Mm. Right.
That's part. We inform. We're not advocating. We're not trying to influence. We're informing them. And we are one part of that process. I think, you know, helping analysts as a leader, I felt that one of the ways that I could help train that was to ask a lot of questions.
Mm.
I wanted them to understand that both testing their arguments, you know, that so if it first I had to be, if you will, clear on what it was that their argumentation, but also hopefully that they understood I cared about what they thought.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have, since having retired, I've been doing some public speaking, I've been doing some consulting. And one of the things I talk about with in the private sector is, look, if the president of the United States can ask questions mm-hmm. and really, you know, admit that there are things that they don't know, I'm hoping that you as a business leader are asking questions of your people and that they actually think you really care what they have to say.
Yeah.
Because otherwise they'll just shut down and you mm-hmm. won't benefit
right.
from their experience and their ideas. So I think you have to model the behavior of asking questions, of being willing to be challenged.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I also want to go back to one thing you said. You talked about being the president's briefer.
Mm-hmm.
So for those who don't know what that actually means, that's wicked cool. Like, what does that actually mean? And then can you just kind of, like, paint the scene for someone? Like, what is that process actually like? What does that feel like? It must be, I imagine it to be pretty surreal.
Exhausting is actually the word. So absolutely. Every president is different in how they take in information.
Mm-hmm.
And Some like to read on their own and then ask questions later. Some like to have a briefer in the room while they're reading at the time and kind of presenting the information. So each one is different. And there's nothing wrong with that. I will say, regardless of what your listeners have heard, I had two metrics that I used during my 37-year career at CIA to measure how effective we were being with the president. And those two key metrics were, did they make time to interact with intelligence, and did they ask questions? Because if they didn't, they don't have to ask the question, but doing so means that they care what we have to think. So when I started, Ronald Reagan was in office. I'm feeling, every time I say that, I feel like a dinosaur. But so when I started, Ronald Reagan was in office. And as I served through all the way through Biden. As President Bush's briefer, though, that was a unique experience. He had a briefer with him wherever he woke up 6 days a week.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
wow. So we traveled, and there were two of us at the time. We worked in it as a team. And wherever he woke up, that's where we were. So I happened to be the briefer during a presidential campaign. So I saw a lot of the U.S. because, you know, he would wake up in Florida, Ohio, or, you know, Nebraska, whatever it might be, and we would be there. So, but when you're here in Washington, for him, think of the president's daily brief as a bit of a classified newspaper, if you will, where the intelligence community has identified, it kind of does a couple of things, identify key things that they think the president needs to know based on his calendar, so the world leaders he's meeting with, on events going on in the world, so, you know, what's going on in Ukraine, what's going on in Israel, and then what I always said was the hardest part, things that are long-term, that it's, you know, beyond their term, you know, whether 4 to 8 years. I always used to call that trying to make them eat their vegetables, to think about, you know, if you don't do something about this weapon system now, 10 years from now, it's going to be more of a problem. So you would have a series of things like that. As the briefer, you're not the expert, but you are trying to represent the expertise of the intelligence community and anticipate that first or second order of questions because you know the customer so well and what they're dealing with. So I would come in every night at about, I'd get up at 12:01 because I used to trick myself into saying, hey, it's Tuesday morning, middle of the night. And I'd get to work at about 1 or 2 in the morning, 1:30 or so in the morning. And then think of it like cramming for finals every morning.
Oh, my gosh.
Because you're really trying to understand the piece. You're trying to understand, how do you make this relevant? Why are we as an intelligence organization or intelligence community thinking that we need to put this in front of one of the busiest people on the planet? President Bush's time was measured in it was scheduled in 5-minute increments. So the 30 minutes to 45 minutes that he would spend with the president's daily brief with his briefers every day, that was incredibly valuable time that could have been reallocated. And we had to earn it every day. So cram for finals. You're trying to figure out exactly what's the real message I want to make sure he understands out of this. If he has questions, do I, you know, have that first order? Do I understand those? Again, not going to be the expert. Part of the job is to be honest and say, I don't know, but I'll get back to you with that. And yeah, we'll get back about it. And then after cramming all morning, as I said, when we were here in Washington, at about 8:00 in the morning, I would go into the Oval Office. And I used to say the day that I went in and I wasn't nervous was the day I shouldn't go, because I was too tired to think about the import of what I was doing. Again, each president's different. President Bush liked to have members of his national security staff there. So it wasn't just him. It was the vice president, the national security advisor. Initially, it was the director of CIA. Eventually, that transitioned during my tenure to the DNI. And then on certain days, they would bring in, his chief of staff would be there. And on certain days, they would bring in maybe the director of FBI or the director of Homeland Security. So you were briefing a kind of a gaggle,
mm-hmm.
of people, but always remembering that the only one that Mm-hmm. You follow the lead of the president on that. So it was a real honor. It was a real challenge, but it was always, I always remembered it being a real honor to be the one to represent the work of so many incredible experts within the intelligence community and to talk about what we're doing and then bring back his reaction, his questions, trying to help formulate. I think they're still struggling with this idea. We need to write something on that.
That's really cool.
That was a great way to describe it. It actually was beautiful, the way you described that job. And thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome. I will say, like I said, the joke about being exhausted, it was true. So with two of us, what we used to do is that we would, one of us would work a week and we would split in the middle of the week. And when it was your off week, you worked days. And so you were constantly switching between night and days. And you would help, you would go to training classes with analysts. You would help shape pieces, you know, ideas, give people ideas for pieces to be writing on, those kinds of things. But I remember at that time, our son was young. He was in elementary school. And so it allowed me most times to be able to pick him up from elementary school. So I would have gotten in at 1 a.m. I would leave work about 2 p.m, maybe 3. I'd pick him up and I'd take him to Taekwondo. Several times a week. And I am convinced that the mothers at Taekwondo thought I had a drinking problem because
oh my gosh.
I would be in the corner. I would bring something to read. I always did. And within about 5 minutes, I was sound asleep with, you know, 30 kids yelling, hi-ya. I'd be like, I'm out.
Oh my gosh.
I'm sure they thought I had some sort of a drinking problem.
That is hilarious. Well,
if only they knew.
If only they knew. Yeah. So you as an analyst of the Middle East, your tenure spanned some really like pivotal times in the Middle East. And I'm wondering if you could share a story or two about, you know, being a Middle East analyst during some really historical moments in history.
So I think that first off, I'll just say that history is being made every day. And so I think that every analyst working in the intelligence community at some point will have stories about how they had some role in things. So you're right, as a Middle East analyst, whether it be the war in Lebanon, the Oslo Accords in Israel, the various intifadas, the efforts to Middle East peace process efforts, all of those were things that, you know, I worked on, Arab Spring. So there's always something going on. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why I think I just loved being an analyst. There was always something going on. Unfortunately, sometimes I used to have to say that bad things in the world was, you know, job security. But and I do feel bad that as I retired, the Middle East was feeling more like when I started and all of the tinder is very dry and ready to explode than other parts of my career. But I guess, let me think if there's one that I can think of that would be a good Middle East story. I think I would probably say that an interesting one was Egypt. After the Arab Spring, with Mubarak's fall, one of the things that we were involved in, there was a lot of congressional interest. You know, the intelligence community, there is a member, you know, CIA is part of the executive branch, but Congress and the legislative branch is also a key customer. And so we did a lot of briefings. And there was a lot of discussion about had there been a coup. And folks may not realize that some of the judgments that you make, some words are really important. If you say there's a coup, there is automatic legislation that falls into place and the U.S. has to take certain actions. And so there was a lot of pressure for us to say it was a coup, but that is actually a policy decision whether to call something a coup. So we had a lot of, it was an unexpected violent change of authority. It was
all these synonyms.
The same thing is true about a civil war in Libya. Was what was going on in Libya. Who gets to designate, is it a civil war? So there are lots of interesting kinds of behind the scenes stories about, you know, thinking about those kinds of things. But as you said, I had a front row seat.
Mm-hmm.
With that, as well as my time working counterterrorism after 9/11, there's a lot of pride in being involved in keeping the U.S. safe. When I retired, one of the things that I said to folks was that I hope everyone, no matter what job they do in their lives, that they have that same sense of satisfaction that I had in retiring, of knowing that I had made a difference in keeping Americans and my loved ones safe. You know, there are stories that people will never hear about plots that we thwarted, and, you know, that I know. Mm-hmm. And I have that sense of satisfaction.
That's really cool. I also, gosh, I could ask a million questions about this. One thing that you said was bad things happening in the world was like job security, right?
Yeah.
Like how, or maybe I'll ask it more in a more open-ended way. Like, did you feel like you could still stay optimistic? Like, did you lose, like, was that, I imagine that just being a very difficult to be constantly reading and briefing about these things that were happening in the world that were very tumultuous or chaotic.
So first and foremost, I think just my personality, I'm a realist. And so it's not about, and I think one of your former guests, Sue Gordon, has talked about being an analyst isn't about talking about the world the way you want it to be. It's talking about the world how it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I applaud that line. Mm-hmm. I think that's really true. But I am optimistic by nature. Because I saw all the amazing things that, you know, whether it be CIA could do, the intelligence community could do. When you put a group of determined people together with expertise and really motivated by mission, there's almost nothing that is impossible. It might just take longer than you want it to. It might, but overall, I'm generally optimistic about the future. It's the same for I'm optimistic about the next generation of folks coming through. I mean, they are truly amazing. And so I think that, again, I'm optimistic that people will find answers.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of touched on this, right before this last question, but I'm going to pull the string a little bit. And you know, we have been asking a lot of our guests about the butterfly effect.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different ways you can touch people's lives or make change in the world. You can do it on an individual level. You could do it on an organizational level or a global scale, all of which I think you've done all three.
I know. I think we've heard stories for all three.
For all three. But if you look at your life and what you have done and accomplished and the way you've touched people's lives or organizational lives, what would you say what effect have you made on?
I'd love to think I've done all three.
I think you have.
and I think that there are, that's probably true that, well, maybe not as an individual, but as part of an organization,
mm-hmm.
Being able to say that you've done that. You know, again, when I retired, when you retire, you get kind of philosophical. And you also get an amazing number of folks who reach out. And so I'll start with the individual side first, because that was the thing that I think I was most personally touched by.
Mm-hmm.
Were the number of folks who reached out to say to me that I had some impact on their lives. Mm. And I'm sorry to say, a lot of them, I don't even remember the incident they're talking about. Whether it was when I was briefer, oftentimes you would have the analysts, the experts would come in at 5 o'clock in the morning to just double check and see anything having changed, and did I have any questions, and those kinds of things. For years afterwards, I used to see people in the hall, and they'd say, hi, I don't know if you remember me, but I briefed you, when you were briefer. And what I usually said to them was something to the effect of, I hoped I said thank you, because I was hopped up on fear and caffeine. So, but the number of them that said, actually, I did, and that I also then reached back to them afterwards to give them some feedback, to help them understand that what they had just done mattered.
That's really cool.
Made a difference. there's also that element of, I don't know when in my career I became a role model. I'm still not actually comfortable saying that. But at some point you do, the more senior you become. And you realize that people are looking at how you treat people and how you act, and it has an influence on them. And again, I got notes from people about a kind word I might have said when they were having problems with, you know, daycare, or a being able to just feel as though they had someone who understood them and was willing to, you know, to just stop and chat, knew their name, whatever. So that kind of thing, I didn't realize just how much of an impact it was having.
Well, and, I mean, like we said before, I can't tell you how many people have reached out to us to say, mm-hmm. you have impacted them in some way, and mm-hmm. they want you on this podcast.
And I think that part of it as well is this idea of it's about how you act when people aren't looking.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's so important. And so that idea that I'm hoping that my own actions, like I said, being willing to be challenged, being willing to jump right in and help someone. One story that always makes me laugh, things were really hot and heavy following the attacks in Benghazi on our U.S. facilities there. I was at that point the head of our Office of Terrorism Analysis. And so folks were working a lot, and I was working a lot. But I remember I went to one briefing, and in the conference room, the director's conference room, and I was in there talking to him about something or other. And there had been a meeting right before with a liaison service, one of our partners. And so for those, there's oftentimes food. So there was this huge plate of cookies that was sitting on the table, and it was the end of the day. And I realized no one else was going to eat those cookies. And so I literally didn't think about it. I just picked up the whole tray of cookies at the end of my briefing, and I walked it over to our other building where I knew there were going to be analysts who were going to be working, you know, all night long. And I just brought the cookies in and sat them down. And didn't say anything about it, didn't even think about it. And for years after that, that story came up over and over again with analysts, because it was just a gesture showing I cared, showing I understood that they were going to be working late, showing that I was right there with them.
You saw them.
I saw them, mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. And I think that that was something, like I said, it would come up all the time. I was like, I always thought it was just the Jewish mother in me. I was like, wait, these cookies are going to go to waste. I need to bring them up. So I think there's that. And yes.
If in doubt, bring cookies.
If in doubt, bring cookies. Now, the flip side of that, years ago when I first started, there was a manager within the director of analysis, then the director of intelligence. I didn't work for him, but he was infamous for saying he never wanted to see his managers bring cookies to the analysts because they're not your friends. They work for you. So, like, you know, there's been an evolution.
Let's just say,
there's been an evolution. Never want to see.
Let's just say I'd rather work for Linda.
Me too.
That is so funny. That's such a good answer. It's so funny how many people come in here, because a lot of women, especially who work in the intelligence community, are drawn to these global problems. And of course, you've all had these global scale impacts. But so many people, when we ask this question, talk about these individual impacts of just seeing changes that you make with people. And I just think that's really special.
Yeah.
And part of it is because I assume there's also, if you really believe, as I do, that what CIA does is a corporate product. And yes, I've had important roles, and I've had, you know, helped to lead the analysis on really important issues and the development of the officers. But you don't look at it as your own individual mm-hmm. accomplishment. You look at it as a team, and the important thing is for the team to succeed.
That's really cool. So I think we're at the end. This has flown by. I feel like this has been jam-packed.
I know.
I feel like I was in the room with her with George W. Bush this whole time. So as you know, we end every episode with the same question, which is, in keeping with the name of our podcast, Iron Butterfly, if you could give yourself a code name, what would it be and why?
Okay, I have to tell you, this was like the hardest question. And I thought about this, and I asked my friends, and the former head of the Directorate of Digital Innovation at CIA. She did what you would expect. She went to ChatGPT and oh put God. In like a prompt and asked what my superhero name should be. I mean, so there was a whole bunch of them. But as in so many things in life, the inspiration that I took for this actually came from my mother. She said, who as a businesswoman, when that was not a common thing, and in so many ways, I'm in awe of her. And she told me that I'm a realist. And so that whatever this name has to have something in there about realism. And so I think mine would be reality check.
Oh, wow.
And I'd say it for two reasons. One, it's about what analysis is. It is about, again, trying to explain, not simplify the world, but explain the world and events and the implications of those events and what the reality is, not necessarily what a policymaker wants it to be. And then the other side is, it's how I also think I treated people. And I think one of the reasons that I had so many people who thanked me afterwards was that I also think that you owe people honesty and reality, and even if, and having difficult conversations. So just like I mentioned earlier about having difficult conversations about substance, having difficult conversations with people about their careers and what is a developmental area for them. You don't have to break someone's will. You can have this in a very positive way. But talking about reality and being willing to not just, you know, push people along. So I would say reality check.
Love it.
I love it,
It's too. Perfect.
It really is.
It's really good is. Hashtag, too. Hashtag.
Linda's about to give you a hashtag reality check.
Yes. Yes. Linda, this, thank you so much for coming and for letting us get to know you a little bit better and our listeners, obviously. Mm-hmm. And thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you. It was, I really enjoyed this. Again, I appreciate what you all are doing. It's important to tell these stories. I was very honored to have been part of CIA's leadership team at a time when all five of our directorates were run by women and the head of the agency was a woman. And I was always cognizant on the fact that we were standing on the shoulders of giantesses, mm-hmm. right? On others, on people, but their stories hadn't been told. Mm-hmm. And so I really love the idea that you're trying to familiarize people with what, you know, the contributions made by women throughout the intelligence community.
It's important.
I think our listeners know the intelligence community a little bit better after listening to Linda.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Linda.
Thank you.
This has been an episode of Iron Butterfly Podcast. We want to thank the National Security Institute at George Mason Scalia Law School, our founding sponsor, and Amazing Women of the IC for their promotion. To learn more about Iron Butterfly Media, visit our website at www.ironbutterflymedia.com. You can also learn more about NSI and upcoming events at nationalsecurity.gmu.edu. And to find out more about AWIC, email amazingwomen.ic@gmail.com. And if you like the show, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe. Lastly, we want to thank our podcast producer, Amanda Young, and the entire Iron Butterfly team. Stay fierce, and we'll talk next time.